It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The man in the big red suit isn't the only one making a list and checking it twice. The man in the red flannel shirt is
working on
a list, too. He's working on a list of New Year's resolutions for your home. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Charity.
Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah.
And so you're getting a head start on resolutions for our homes this year.
Yes, I am. I thought I better start now. And I never really follow them anyway, so it's just kind of a guideline, you know. Because, usually it's like be safe, you know, try not to get hurt. And I can honestly say that as old as I am now, that I finally know what it feels like when you barely touch the blade of a table saw with your finger. You know, for anybody that's ever done that, you know, you can actually feel every little piece of that blade going around.
So that was your 2014 injury?
Yeah, but it wasn't a big one. I mean, it was Band-Aid one that, you know, I was able to wipe
your
up.
Your finger looks almost normal.
Almost normal, yeah. It's got that Michael Strahan kind of bend in a couple of the fingers, yeah. But other than that.
All right, so what do you have on your list, Bill?
Well, some of them are kind of dull because you have to get serious. But, if one of the things that I've been noticing going around talking with different people through the year, I think it may be an attitude adjustment. I think some people need to toss their egos. And I've learned a lot. Well, you know, if you go into teaching and you work with kids long enough, you learn you better not have an ego because they'll cut you down pretty fast anyway. But, you know, when we go on and we try to ask people for help or someone comes in and wants to do a job for you, sometimes the ego gets in the way because they don't listen to the customer, what the customer really wants, what the homeowner wants. I was talking with a fellow this week that he's had some issues with a home that's about 3 years old. And, he's kept asking, well, I need this done, because he's done his research. And the builder said, well, we've always done it this way. And that kind of attitude is causing a lot of friction. And the builder isn't doing the right thing. It's just because he's always done it that way. And things have changed. So I think a lot of people kind of just lighten up a little bit and get rid of the ego. And I think things in the next year go a lot better between, you know, the home improvement experts and the people that they're trying to serve.
So everybody needs to set aside their egos.
Everybody,
when it comes to your house. You need to listen to what, if you're in the home improvement field, you need to listen to what the homeowner wants. And if you are the homeowner, you need to listen to the expert.
Yes, you need to, because, you know, you get on the internet maybe and all of a sudden, you know, you've spent a couple hours reading about a particular topic, and now all of a sudden you think you're the expert. And you got to remember about maybe 10% of the stuff out there really applies to your particular, you know, situation. When I do presentations, I've noticed that, you know, the best credibility I can ever do or get is I'll stand up there usually for the first couple of minutes and tell them all the mistakes, you know, or say, remember when we did this? And, the builders my age, you know, they're hiding behind their booklet or, you know, or whatever, their paperwork, so that I don't call on them. And you know, you admit your mistakes, you learn from them and try to progress. But sometimes
Bill, this is heavy stuff. This isn't just for home improvement. This is for all of life.
Hold on, let me get my feet up a little bit. Here we go.
Have you considered a life coach as a?
Whoops.
What are you doing? All right, let's move on the list.
Yeah, let's go ahead. Now that I've thumped the speaker with my big foot, one of the other things was if something's always been done that way, maybe we should change because it's probably outdated. It could be unsafe and, it could be possibly wrong. One of the things that we've seen this year is some of the building methods and some of the techniques aren't matching up with materials. The materials have changed just like computers. It's amazing. You drive by houses now and seeing them built. You know, you see Tyvek, the white house wrap or a different type of house wrap on the outside. You don't really see, you know, layers of felt paper on the roof now. There's all these different types of materials. And one thing that we're seeing is we may be jumping a little bit too fast on some of the materials. We're relying too much on adhesives. We're relying too much on products that have been, you know, microwaved and pressured and pressed and ovens and put together, and it's not you know, like, say, real wood, we call it was wood, or one person even says some of the manufactured materials, he calls it spam for mold. That's one of the things he uses because it it takes on so much moisture. We need to really start thinking about maybe looking back, you know, and here's a case where we say, well, you know, we've always done it this way. Some of the things that we did 50 years ago still apply. Some don't. Some of the things that really do apply is water has to drain away from a building. Water has to be able to escape the walls. Water shouldn't be in your attics, you know, things like that. And one of the things that has come up in the last couple of weeks is when we try to get an energy audit, that's one of the things that we may want to do for the next year is, like, do a self-energy audit first. What you do is pull your utility bills out, and every month it'll say what the average temperature was last year on this month and what the average temperature this year. And then it'll, you know, tell you basically what you use for energy. Start kind of keeping maybe a little journal of what you think you're using during that month and what you can cut down on. Because if you've used, say, more energy, but it was warmer this year, you're thinking, okay, why? Did you run some fans? Did you bring in these little portable heaters, you know, on a cord and run it in a room for, say, maybe a couple days? You can cut back on some energy that way just by looking at your use. But also maybe go up and now that it's warm, okay, it's, what, 30, 32 out there. Now the next time that it quickly goes down to maybe into the teens, pop up your attic hatch. Look up in your attic. And see, just look straight up and see if there's frost on the roof deck, which the roof deck is the bottom of the roof. If you see, like, reflections, or it looks like there's glitter up there, or it's white, excuse me, then there's an issue with air leakage. And energy audits, you know, they look at basically how much you've paid the utility bill. They don't tell you about how much moisture is sneaking up in your attic. Maybe some decay is happening, some wood is starting to fall apart or be saturated, and why your shingles may be coming off prematurely, you know, curling, things like that. What we found out is in the 70s, and I'm as guilty as anybody, when we were building in the 70s, we didn't think anything about airflow. And for builders, you know, this should be something they should really be thinking about this year is, yeah, we can add insulation, we can do this and that. But if we go up in the attic, and especially the 70s and 80s houses that we were building, we had a lot of soffits. That's a area, say, in your kitchen and bathroom, you know, where you put the can lights, you know, or the cabinets would go up, and then they'd hit this little bump out on the ceiling that's called a soffit. We always framed that soffit first, and then we would sheetrock the outside of it. And so where those lights were, or a lot of times we put a range hood in that soffit, the range hood would go up into that and throw the air. We didn't care where. We just hooked it up and, you know, turn the fan on. Hey, it works. Now we go into these buildings, go up in the attic, and we're seeing all this frost. And the plywood's delaminating. Water's dripping down to the ceiling, coming through the lights. And we get up there, and you can either, say, use a temperature thermometer, you know, these ones that has a little laser on there, about $50, and kind of go across the roof, and you can see the temperature's changing. Or, in my case, if you wear glasses, you can walk through the attic, and all of a sudden your glasses start fogging up. Stop and look down, and a lot of times that's where the soffit was, and we just laid fiberglass across the top of it, so we have this huge 2-foot hole. You move it, the fiberglass or whatever insulation out of the way, and all of a sudden your glasses fog completely over it. Warm, moist air comes up, and then it's ruining the whole attic. It doesn't really matter how much ventilation we have. So we have to stop just insulating attics. We have to air seal them first. Then we have to add insulation. That's why it's a state law in Minnesota. You just can't go up and add insulation. You know, if you get an energy audit, a lot of times they'll say, okay, add more insulation to your attic. In many cases, that could be the worst thing you could possibly do, so you have to air seal first. I'm helping on a project right now where they're pulling all the old insulation out, and it looks like a brand-new building when you're up in the attic looking down at the gypsum board at the top of the ceiling. And then they're air sealing first, and they're putting all new insulation in.
Okay, so airflow is extremely important.
Yes.
Moisture is extremely important.
Yeah. So we need to, you know, stop thinking about like our values. We talk a lot about that. We have to get back to the, you know, the basics of stopping that air so the insulation can work. Because everybody says, oh, my insulation is the best. Well, it's not working. No insulation is going to work unless the air is dead, unless it's stopped.
Okay. What else? We've got just about a minute and a half before we get to the break. What else is on your resolution list there, Bill?
Okay. Well, you know, one of the other things is really pay attention to your research that you're doing. When we do research, you know, as much as we can, pay attention to where you live. If there's a listener here from, say, southeast Iowa, down along the Mississippi River, the information that they get is going to be completely different to someone in Spirit Lake. The houses are, you know, probably built different, a little bit different down there than they are in Spirit Lake. Our weather's drastically different in southeast Iowa than what it is in northwest Iowa. It's said that the difference in weather from the very southeast part of Iowa just to Dubuque is the same as Dubuque to Duluth, Minnesota.
Really?
You know,
wow.
2 hours from the Canadian border.
Well, I grew up in Cedar Falls and I live in Iowa City now. I feel that difference every day.
There, you know, and
here
people,
in the French people, Riviera of
people
Iowa.
People don't believe you. You know, you're 2 hours different. And there's a drastic difference. And different parts of towns, like Beaverdale. In the Des Moines area, that's a microclimate. It's, you know, it's
really
so much more mild there than, say, Fort Dodge. And because, you know, the city surrounds it. And so when you do your research, half of these articles come from somebody writing an article in Carolina, you know, or Washington. So, or, you know, you get on and you look at Pinterest, you look at it house, and you look at all these different places to get ideas. Half of them don't apply to us.
All right. So pay attention to
where the research is coming from. Yes.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to answer your questions. You can join us at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today, ready to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. He's also got some holiday gift ideas we'll sprinkle in throughout the rest of the show today. Stepladder, right?
Yes, at least a 300-pounder, because if you've got friends like me, nobody's less than 300 pounds by the time you put all the tools on your belt and you're up on a ladder trying to lift something. So you need to be thinking about
a good, solid stepladder.
Yes.
All right. If
fiberglass.
You want Bill to come to your house and help you fix something, you need to have a good stepladder.
Yeah.
All right. Here's an email from Bob in Cumming. Can Bill address the best way to keep the humidity level up in our home that has in-floor radiant heat on both levels? That's the only source of heat, and it works well to keep the home comfortably warm, but traditional humidifiers used on forced air furnaces are not an option.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question, because normally, you know, if it's a fairly new house, you'll usually have almost too much humidity no matter what kind. Usually on an in-floor type system like this, we run into too much humidity. You know, that's a good question. You may have to put in a separate system humidifier, and I'm trying to think. You should go to a place called Shelter Source. Just Google Shelter Source. And then humidifier, and they have some specific type of units that would apply for you. And I would, if you can't find anything on their online catalog or information there, go ahead and call them. And I that's who I usually go to when I can't find something specific, when it's ventilation or really what's up and coming, what's working. And because there again, you know, here's a very efficient system. I mean, that's the best efficient system, but, you know, it's hard to get air conditioning and it's hard to get humidification,
right?
Because you don't have the ductwork to distribute that airflow. Just ask for Mike.
All right.
And that should help you there. But there is a lot of new equipment that's coming out, because there's a lot of houses that are going to that type of of heating and cooling, because radiant is really it's a real comfortable. Mm-hmm. When you look at efficiency, it's funny. When you do all the numbers, if you just look at numbers, a lot of times it doesn't pencil out. And I've never understood that, you know, but it's strictly numbers and it's not so much comfort and how you feel. So that's sometimes, you know, like airflow. You can draw all the goofy blue and red arrows where the air is supposed to go in a drawing, and that's not what actually is happening in a particular house sometimes. So, yeah, I would look at shelter source.
Okay. Let's go to the phones, 866-780-9100. Fred is on the line in Grinnell. Hi, Fred.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
When we had the house re-roofed, it's a ranch house. It doesn't have much of a pitch to it. There's a pine tree that's on the south side. It has very short needles. And the roof vent that goes the full length of the cap of the house now has a bunch of pine needles stuck down in those vent holes.
Yeah.
How am I going to get all that little stuff out of there?
You know, the only way is it's just a one heck of a good soffit vent. And there are different types of vent. Is it it's a continuous ridge vent? It's a soffit
correct.
Vent? Or is it the ridge vent that has it?
Right up on top of the house, so I guess that'd be the ridge vent.
Okay. Yeah, you may want, you know, if you're going to have to make a decision, do I want to keep the pine tree? Or do I want to, you know, have that ventilation system work the way it is? It depends on what type of ridge vent it is. Some of them, is it the one that has the little louvers and has foam and black foam in between the little plastic louvers?
No, I couldn't tell you. It's got little bitty long little holes. I get a little ladder, you know, lengthwise holes go up and down.
Oh, okay.
And it's like 2 years worth of that stuff stuck in there. I take an air compressor and go up there on the roof and blow all the needles off with a power nozzle and try to keep that stuff from getting in there.
Yeah, I'd use a vac and try to pull it out because I don't know what's on the inside of there. It still may be, you know, maybe kind of coagulating a little bit on the inside. Yeah,
get up on his roof with a vacuum.
Yeah, just like
that
a shop
easy.
Vac. Yeah. Or you can do it. Yeah. I got all these visions in my head now that you said that. You know,
be careful.
Yes,
Fred.
Please. And use a 300-pound ladder, by golly. I'd vacuum it out. And maybe if you don't really need the tree, you know, you make a decision there. But if the house is, you know, let's say if you have a really good air-sealed attic, we're also finding out that the attic ventilation sometimes isn't as important as what we used to think so in the past. There's a lot of building scientists that say it's really unneeded. By code, you still have to have it. I mean, that's a big building science argument right now. But I'd vacuum them out and try to stay ahead of it. But, yeah, you know, it's probably every time those needles fall, the wind takes it and just shoves it right up underneath there. The other thing is you may be able to kind of fabricate some sort of a screen. Yeah, just a fabric screen to fold over it in that particular area. Then you can just pull that off and shake it and put it back on. That may be probably your easiest thing.
Switching subjects, at the other house, the raccoons now climb some way up on the house. I put aluminum collars on the two or three trees that are even vaguely close to the house so they can't get up there. You suppose they're climbing up the downspout to get up on the roof and try tearing the heck out of the shingles to
get
in? Yeah,
you know what? I watched one climb up the support post to my deck. He reached out, grabbed that downspout, you know, where it comes from the gutter and kind of curves in and comes down the pole. That critter climbed right up that and grabbed a hold with grabbed with one leg on the gutter and whipped himself right back up on the roof. Yeah, so they will. I can't believe how that big of an animal is that agile, but I've watched him do it.
Well, Fred, good luck. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Linda is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Linda.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show.
Thanks. What's your question?
Don't have an attic. Have dormers. Have a 1,000-square-foot house. Charming, cute, and cold.
Okay.
Runs around 68 degrees here. I think I have there probably 4 inches of insulation between the ceiling and the roof because it's dormers. There is no attic.
Okay. So there's no attic, but so it's just the thickness of the rafter then, right? Is okay. Yeah, this is where you kind of have to make you can insulate those completely full. They call it sometimes they call them cold roofs, sometimes hot roofs, where they completely fill that up. That gets a little bit tricky, especially on an older home. But in some cases, you're going to have to make a decision. You can either re-roof the house if the shingles are starting to maybe get their age, and what they will do then is they will put sheets of foam on the roof and do a build-up roof. Like, so they may put 2 to 4 inches of foam on top of your roof, put new sheeting down, and then new shingles. Or what some people do is if their ceilings are starting to maybe show cracks and starting to not really look the best, sometimes they will do it from the inside. They will put foam on the ceiling and then re-drywall. But it gets really tricky on homes like what you're talking about, because you can easily cause some moisture issues. You could cause some material decay issues as well. So you may have to, you could have to bring a builder in and say, okay, what's my best option? How old are you? How old are the shingles on your roof right now?
These shingles probably 7 years old.
Okay. Yeah. You're just going to have to kind of make that decision. What's it going to pencil out at? What am I paying, per month, per utility, bills? Is it going to be worth it to me to go ahead and cut them down significantly? But stay away from any, that's another good New Year's resolution. Stay away from anything that has exaggerated claims. Things like, we're going to put some, a radiant barrier up on your roof, and it's going to save you 50% of your utility bills. Be really careful of products like that. You have to stay with the tried and true in this case.
Okay.
Yep. But I would get an experienced builder that understands working with a foam insulation on roof decks.
All right, Linda, thank you so much for your call. And next up, let's go to Joe. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's your question?
I apologize if this is changing the subject too much, but I have a question about installing a sump pump in an old house. It was built in the 30s, and for the first 5 years when we lived there, we never had any issues with water in the basement. But for the past two, as we've gotten these real heavy rains, the water has seeped in from one particular wall on one side of the basement. And I'm wondering if where the water is coming in is in the finished part of the basement. If I were to install a new sump pump down there, does it have to be in that spot where the water is coming in, or could I position it over on a different side of the basement where it's more conducive to install it?
That's a good question. It's it really depends on what kind of soil and what kind of, say, granular material is underneath your basement floor or around your foundation. Probably back then, all of those just, they poured them right on top of whatever's there. I mean, it could be clay, could be gravel. It's probably clay, if you got the water coming in that particular point. It's really funny. Even in my brother's house, we put a sump pump about 12 feet away from another one. The other one wasn't letting in any water, and this one we could hardly keep up with the water coming in while we were digging it. It's amazing, how that water moves underneath there. If you're real glutton for punishment, I'd try to put one in the closest you possibly can and see if that takes care of it. And then if it doesn't, well, then you're going to have to bite the bullet and go over and put it where it is. Now, it's not that – I know it's finished and everything, but sometimes it's not that hard to hide them. You're going to want a sealed lid on it anyway. Maybe you can just, do some, set of shelves or something that's built out to hide the pipe going up. You can get pretty creative with that. But, if it was me, I would try the one closest to that finished area first, because it's surely not going to hurt to try that. And, but in a house in the 30s, most of those were, like I say, were just put right on whatever soil was there.
Yeah. Do people ever run the outlet on those sump pumps into a floor drain?
No. Well, you shouldn't. No. Okay. In most places, it's illegal to do that. It should go to the outside. But in a 30s house, is it in town or is it out in the country?
In town.
Yeah. Yeah. You wouldn't want to do that, because you could overflow because that's pumping it into the sanitary sewer. And in most communities, it's illegal to do that. They're really starting to clamp down on that.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. And because they come by and they put colorant in. They do all kinds of sneaky things to make sure you're not doing it anymore. But don't pump it out so that it goes in, onto the curb and gutter either, because some communities won't allow you to do that either. They'll let you go to the storm sewer. You might be lucky and have the storm sewer on your side of the street and maybe down a few feet, and you can tap into that. But whenever you do that, you want to make sure and have a back check valve so that if you do tie into any of those particular systems, that, you know, city storm, that when it's overcharged, that it doesn't come into your house. So a lot of times it's just best off putting it into the yard.
Okay. Very
All right.
Good.
Yeah, that's right, no, that's a good question.
Thanks a lot for your call. And we have another sump pump question from Steve in Des Moines. Hi, Steve.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, where my sump pump pumps out through the side of the house, this thing pumps pretty much all year.
Okay.
It's freezing, you know.
Yeah.
And I was down there the other day and I heard the pump running, and, you know, it wasn't able to pump out. So anyway, I took the hose off, and then, of course, it spills out onto the ground. I think it's just making a loop, you know.
Yeah, yep.
But I don't know. I bought a big piece of 3-inch PVC, and it's, you know, it's kind of draining into there. I don't think it'll freeze up quite as fast that way. But is there any kind of heater or anything you think of?
No, you know, that's probably the best thing to do is put it in a large pipe. And in some cases, just to give you an example, if sometimes when you have a well and it's a free-flowing well, it would be almost like a sump pump constantly running. I have one up north that puts about a gallon and a half a minute, comes out of that pump, and you can't shut it off. By state law, you can't. So it's constantly running all winter. And I was nervous as heck about, okay, what's going to happen with that water? Is it going to freeze? Is it going to blow everything apart? So I looked it up, and what they recommend is you put it into a 4 to 6 inch, like, black ADS tile, kind of like what you're doing. Yeah. And you lay that out, and then I took mine about 50 feet out, and the water, you know, the record colds that we had up in Minnesota last year, I went up and I couldn't believe it. You know, there was 4 feet of snow everywhere except above that pipe, and I basically had a hallway down through the snow because that water went through the pipe and it would never freeze because, you know, it kept it warm enough that whole distance. Okay. But don't get the perforated. Yeah, get the, you know, the non-perforated pipe.
No.
Yeah, but, no. You know, and that's always tough. Mm. That situation is what you have, especially if you can't, like the previous caller, we can't put it into the sanitary. So maybe, you know, if you can, you know, see if there's someplace else that you can run it into the storm, if, you know, from now on, that will keep it down below that frost level.
Well, there's a pretty good slope on the side of the house.
You might be just fine. You know, and what some guys will do is they'll just next summer go ahead and dig a trench down 4 feet and put your pipe down there and run it out.
All right.
If you've got that much slope, that'd be great. That's a good one, too.
Steve, thank you so much
thanks.
For your call. Let's do an email question. This is from Erica. We have, pardon me.
Oh. Well.
No longer ability to speak.
Yes.
We have a living room that's very dark. Next spring, I'd like to install either skylights or sun tunnels. I've heard mixed reviews of the sun tunnels as far as how much light they actually let in. I'm also worried about water leakage with a skylight. Do you have any advice?
Valid concerns. the sun tubes. If you get one of the better brands, do some research. You know, really check the reviews on those. The ones that I've seen are really good. I mean, they let a tremendous amount of light in. Some of them have a lot. You know, basically what you see is that like an opaque globe on the ceiling. From the inside, you don't, you know, nobody even knows. They just think it's a light fixture. And then there's a light on the inside, an LED light, so that at night it serves a dual purpose. If they're put in by a very experienced installer, you won't have any leaks with either one. They put them on at the right time of the year. They use the right flashings. The better names, you know, there's like that, Velux and you know, the big window companies all have their one. We put some in, some Andersons years ago, and I couldn't believe how good of flashing systems and waterproofing systems that those had on the actual unit. And we would, when there was slush and that, we'd flood them as kind of a practice to see they would not leak. The one issue sometimes you do have, though, is you get condensation on the inside. The skylights have like a little condensate tray on the bottom side, the downhill side. And so any condensation on the glass comes down, kind of sits in that. So there is a little bit of maintenance. You're going to have to clean that goop out of there that grows inside that tray. You're going to have maybe have some moving air across it so it doesn't fog over. And on the sun tubes, they have to be installed with the right insulation on the outside of them, or you could have some real condensation issues and moisture issues in the attic. So there's a lot of directions. So somebody, that's another one for this year. Read all the directions to everything.
All right. Do your homework before you do the
project. Yeah, do your homework on both of those.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today, ready to answer your questions. You can join us by sending an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or call 866-780-9100. Here's another email question from Mike in Nevada. I have a concrete floor about 4 years old in a garage that has a crack. It started sometime this fall. It's not yet wide enough to slip a dollar bill into the crack. Do you have a recommendation on how I can perform a repair before I have to slip more dollars to a concrete professional?
Well, especially garage floors, if they're unheated, they're always going to crack. I mean, that's why a lot of times whenever, you know, I pour or friends, when we pour concrete, we'll always put re-rot in the concrete, and we always get fiber mesh, which is glass fibers in the concrete, and we get 4,000-pound strength. And garage floors, we always pour 5.5 to 6 inches thick. You know, we really go overboard. And with all that reinforcement in there, they still crack. Concrete always does, always will. I mean, it does. All the re-rod thing is hold the pieces together so they don't go up and down and pull apart. So, you know, really about all you can do is you can caulk that, or you can, there's some different epoxies. Most of the time it's just cosmetic. And I know that when you pay for concrete, you look at it and you think, you know, I don't want to see that crack. Well, you know, then you'd have to go with something else other than that's why I have to wear a paper bag over my head all the time is, you know, but there are different products. You know, there's specific types of concrete that are for small cracks and large cracks. And the thing is, when it's a very small, if you can't get a dollar into it right now, it's going to be hard for anything to inject down in there except maybe an epoxy. It's hard to get something in it because caulking is just kind of sticking on the surface, and it's not going to have enough to grab onto. So, you know, it'll probably pull out. And what you may do to keep maybe cut down on some of it is, I don't know if you have control cracks already in there, control cuts already in the concrete. Even in the garage floor, a lot of times what they'll do is they'll maybe take the garage, measure it. Let's say it's 24, come in 12 feet. And if it's 24 foot deep, come in 12 feet and just cut it into four equal sections. And then that will release some of the pressure in the concrete maybe there's some settling. Maybe there's sand underneath it that's settling that is going to cause more cracks, so that the cracks will be controlled into these cracks that you put in yourself, basically, is all they are, is a cut. That's why in sidewalks you see all these marks. It's not for decoration. You know, they'll cut it with a saw, or they'll use a concrete cutting type device tool that as they're pouring the concrete, where the concrete's thinner, it will crack there. And so that you can control all of that, because it expands and contracts just like anything else does when it's heat and cold. So I'm sorry to say, but, you know, that's always been, and you're tired of hearing it, but they always say one guarantee is it is going to crack.
All right. Mark is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Oh, I'd like to talk about those reflections. My work through my years, I'm 75, as you know, has always been historic restoration work on the old buildings. And I'm working on buildings that are 100 plus years old, and they're still held together with old technology.
Yep. Yeah, they are.
When I started building this hospice for myself, my last house, for myself. I've been away from stick-built housing. And I started subscribing to Fine Home Building and some of these other esoteric magazines to bring myself up to speed. And I see a lot of these new building materials that are in there. And they say it's good for 50 years.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm impressed. Some of the old ways they did things have lasted a long time. And I'd like your reflection on it, like this TVEC. They found out that stuff's not what it's cracked up to be when you start dealing with moisture.
There's a, you know, there's some workshops coming up in January that Alliant Mid-American and Cedar Falls Utilities are putting on, and some of the topics are basically what you're talking about. It's amazing when you go to Europe and those buildings are 300, 400, 500 years old, and you come here and or have somebody from Europe or Russia come over, and then they laugh at us because we're building. They laugh when we say 50 year. And like you say in the magazines, they say it lasts 50 years. Like, that's something to be proud of. That's not anything to be proud of, that anything you do is only going to last 50 years. Some of the products that we use, some of the methods that we use are fast. They're inexpensive. And this is personal opinion. And they're profit driven. And I get into tremendous heated arguments with people when they say, well, we're just building this house because this is what this customer wants, or they're not going to pay for any more, or this person's only going to live there 3 to 4 years. Well, that house is going to be there for longer, and ethically, you should be building something that's going to at least be 100.
Do you think we're going to have a crisis in about 25, 30 years with all of the new construction?
We're in crisis right now.
Okay.
I personally think. I do have some people that completely disagree. I go, okay, well, look at the building science. Look at what we're building. We're building 34, 50 maybe year old, you know, houses for that. There's some houses I know of right now that aren't going to last the life of their first mortgage.
Hmm.
When I get a lot of calls that we don't talk about on the show. I go into building failures. That's what I really like. When I go into a house that's 2 or 3 years old and it's structurally failing, there's moisture issues, the builder says, well, you know, that's the way I've always done it. Well, then maybe we ever go back and look at the last 100 houses you built, because they're all built the same way. We do have to look back and tap into some of the people like this gentleman. Okay, he's been in historic restoration. He's 75 years old. There's a tremendous amount of knowledge that he has that somebody needs to be tapping in and find out, okay, you're doing historic restoration. What's holding up and what's causing your issues, especially in historic preservation? You have a brick building that's lasted 200 years, let's say. You stick one coat of the wrong sealer on the outside, and that building's going to be trash in just a few.
Wow.
I can take you to houses that have walls right now when it's cold that are frozen because we aren't paying attention to some of the materials we're using and some of the techniques. So I'll get off my high horse, but he's exactly right. We've kind of lost the craftsmanship side. I'm not saying all. I'm not
right.
at all. There are a lot of really good builders out there, but some that are, you know, strictly, you know, hate. So there's a few that are strictly profit driven. You know, me personally, I think they should be building garages. You know, so.
All right.
But he's got a really good point.
Mark, thank you so much for your call and bringing that up. Next
yeah,
up, we've got.
Thanks. Now that I'm all warmed up,
right. We've got Carol on the line next in Guttenberg. Hi, Carol.
Oh, thank you. Oh gosh, that was really interesting. You can just keep on talking.
Yeah. Let's have something lighthearted here now.
Okay. Well, this is lighthearted.
Okay.
I appreciated the woman. That you got the email from about light in her living room.
Okay.
I cannot live without light. But anyway, getting to my kitchen, I live in an old farmhouse which needs to have the kitchen and back porch remodeled, mainly the back porch. And they are separated by a complete wall and a door. It's an enclosed back porch. But we need a roof badly, and I would like to be able to combine the two rooms.
Okay.
But if we do not raise the roof line, then we are going to be hitting our heads on the roof of the back porch, if you understand what
yes,
I'm saying.
Yes, I do. Yep.
Okay. You speak.
Yeah, I understand completely what you're saying. Now, what you can do is, you know, the roof that goes out has probably has a fairly good angle to it right now, doesn't it? somewhat of a pitch.
It's almost like the kitchen is, you know, this little house, and then the back porch is not too steep a roof off of that.
Okay. Well, you know, in some cases, what you may be able to do is, I don't know, when they remodel, I don't know how much space, because it depends on which way the roof's going to, but if they can raise the roof, kind of put a false roof up above the one that's above the kitchen, if there's not a window up above the old farmhouses, you usually had a window up there though, but if you can take the roof all the way up to within about 6 inches of that window and then run a new roof that goes all...
There's no window. There's just
Okay.
It's only one story. The kitchen is one story.
Okay. Oh, okay.
With a crawl space underneath, and I don't know if I mentioned that the back porch, you have to step down, and it's just a concrete floor.
Oh, okay. Well, there's some – yeah, you've got a lot of issues going on there because, you know, that porch may not have, footings underneath it. If it's an old farmhouse, it probably doesn't have insulation underneath there. It may be such a case that they may just take the porch completely off, redo the whole thing, and put a flatter metal roof or a rubber roof over that. The metal would be better.
Okay.
Sometimes you have to step back and say, you know, this just isn't going to work in this case. Somebody can get very creative. You may be able to – maybe I'll turn the roof the other direction, perfect 90 degrees. And do it, but that porch, if you still want to keep that porch has to have footings underneath it, and it has to have insulation underneath the floor, and the crawl space under the kitchen should be sealed as well.
Right.
Without seeing it, may be able to turn that roof and put a pitch above it and go 90 degrees if there's no window up there.
Well, then to shorten this up, do you have any advice as to where I would go to ask the question?
Go to your local lumberyard, they'll be able to recommend a good builder in your area. And the nice thing about going to local lumberyards is most of the time they're working with people that are just getting into the business that are very aggressive and very fair and a lot of times very knowledgeable. Or they're working with contractors that they've worked with for years and years and years. And the only reason that they've worked with them that long is they're dependable as well. And they've stood behind their work. So, I think sometimes we kind of miss out on talking with the local lumberyards, local builders, supply areas, and finding out, you know, who the reputable builders are in town. A lot of times they don't advertise because they're plenty busy the way it is by word of mouth. So sometimes you can only catch the really good ones, by word of mouth.
All right, asking a lot of questions.
Ask a lot of questions, yeah. But, right. I hate to say it, you may have to rebuild a lot, but, you know, somebody be creative and come up with something.
Carol, thank you so much for your call. Keith is on the line next in Woodward. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Enjoy your program. Bill, thanks. I have a question about a remodeling project that we're working on. I have a 1,200-square-foot house that we've completely gutted down to the studs, taking up flooring, had to remove the heater and all of the duct work from it. Trying to decide whether we go back with a central air unit and have to reinstall all new duct work, or look at some of these heating cooling room units that
sure.
you see in hotels and I don't know, the Panasonic, LG,
yep.
Mitsubishi all make them. What are your thoughts?
Well, I personally like those, the mini split heat pumps. I personally like those. In fact, I put one in at a place up in northern Minnesota. They're good down to about maybe 5 degrees, and then you have to have, like, say, baseboard heat. Really efficient on the cooling side. If you weigh the whole, you know, with 1,200 square foot, if you weigh everything together, a lot of times the mini splits will come out. Especially if you insulate and air seal this building right, and you're going to come out way ahead.
Really?
Yeah. But there again, if you it's kind of a catch 22. If you insulate this and seal it and make it efficient, a very small air handling unit with a minimum of ductwork will then be able to handle it as well. So, you know, I would get a, you know, talk with your heating and cooling person that's familiar with both. Fujitsu, you know, LG. I put in a Frederick's unit because it was a do-it-yourself unit. That's, I'm very, very happy with it. Get one that's very familiar with both, because there is there's a real strong movement, especially in apartment buildings, is switching out to these smaller units because they don't have the ductwork.
Yep, apartment units, nursing homes, you're seeing them in, and
you're seeing them all over the place, especially in remodel projects, and in a lot of cases, many of them will do it because then, since there isn't any ductwork, that's one less thing that needs to be inspected, and it's amazing how efficient the newer ones are. You know, you can have an outside unit handle up to 8 heads on the inside. I think Fujitsu's does that, or Mitsubishi's. I would get somebody that's familiar with both and doesn't have a predominant opinion either or. One that's really open-minded and say, I need you to do on your house, you need to do a Model J, which is, you know, figure out what the heat load is, and a Model S. And that will, you know, tell you what, you know, all your equipment that you need. And then have him, if he's going to do the HVAC with duct, have him do a model, a D as well, that does the ductwork design and everything. But it has to be designed according to what you have done. So make sure they do a Model J either way, and he'll understand what we're talking about. It's all into the design. So I kind of hope you end up going with the mini splits. Because it's something new. But
all right, Keith, thank you so much, Keith, for your call. Let's try to slip one more in. This is Aaron in Des Moines. Quickly, Aaron.
Hi. Hi, Charity. Hi, Bill. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I have a window question. During the winter, we have problems with condensation collecting on the interior of our windows.
Yep.
We've got a large wall of double-hung windows with transoms above them, and the condensation tends to collect along the bottom edge of the glass on the upper sash and the transom windows.
Okay.
And we've noticed that the condensation is starting to cause water damage where the glass meets the wood.
Yes.
So is there anything that we can do to reduce the amount of condensation, and then how do we kind of, going forward, care for and maintain those problem spots?
Well, do you have blinds or curtains on them right now?
We've got blinds, and I usually close them at night, but then try to open them up first thing in the morning.
Yeah, that's kind of the sometimes that's a little bit of the issue. Is I hate to say it, but you know, to have a healthy amount of humidity in the house in the winter, sometimes it's too much for the window to handle. You know, because the glass can only do so much. Open them up a couple inches on the bottom at night to a little bit of air go in there. But if they're a wood window, and to keep a healthy amount of humidity, you may have to just keep cleaning them up or lower the humidity, and then you're just shooting lightning bolts at each other. It's just something we run into in Iowa. That window can only do so much.
All right, we're out of time. Aaron, thank you so much for your
call.
Bill McAnally, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.